We're in 2 Kings chapter 17, really finishing up the chapter. We read through to the end of it, and just to refresh ourselves briefly, 2 Kings chapter 17 is one of the longer chapters in the book of 2 Kings, and it has explained to us the fall of Samaria and the northern kingdom of Israel. Those that were left were carried away into captivity by the Assyrians, and they were scattered in places that were named in verse 6, and in the cities of the Medes and elsewhere. And they were never returned to the land of Israel. These were ones that had turned away from the Lord. As we mentioned, the duration of that northern kingdom was 208 years from after Solomon's death, and the division of the kingdom that first began to be ruled over by Jeroboam the son of Nebat over those 10 tribes of Israel, and then all of his successors, the 18 kings that followed him down through Hosea, the last of those kings of the northern kingdom of Israel, and he was the king that we saw in the beginning of this chapter, and the last one. But through that 208 years of their history, they had been in rebellion against God and had not returned to him, and they had not listened to the Lord's prophets that he sent them. And so the Lord explains in this chapter why he brought them to an end and why they were carried away as captives. And these were people that were indistinguishable from the world in their ways, in all of their the way they lived their lives and the religion that they practiced. It was wrong. It was of the world. And so when they were carried away captive, I mean, they were removed from the physical land of Israel, but they were they had not been children of God in their hearts for many, many generations, and so they were lost to history, and from that point, as they just blended in with the world that they were a part of, from that point onward, the Lord explains why he did that, because of all of their transgressions for all those years, and the Lord's efforts to bring them to repentance that they had rejected. And Judah was left alone, but even Judah, up to this time that we've been reading about under the reign of King Ahaz, had turned to wickedness, as we know. Hezekiah is their next king that we're shortly going to begin reading about, Lord willing, but he was one that loved the Lord and trusted the Lord in spite of having that wicked father, Ahaz, that he did. Hezekiah loved the Lord and served him. And brought the people back to God under his reign. So there's going to be one of the better times that we read about through the history of the kings. Few and far between they are, but one of those very good times under the reign of Hezekiah we read about next. But the Lord then spent the rest of 2 Kings chapter 17 telling us about the people that were brought into the land of Israel. So it started by telling us about who was taken out and why. But now the Assyrians, not leaving the land empty, brought in people from, it told us in verse 24, that they were men from Babylon and Cutha and Ava and Hamath, Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel, and they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. And verse 29 already uses the term or the name that they came to be known by, as it tells us in 2 Kings 17:29, what their religious practices and what they did when these people came into the land, howbeit every nation made gods of their own and put them in the houses of the high places, which the Samaritans had made, every nation in their cities wherein they dwelt. So they were referred to as Samaritans from then on. These are the Samaritans we read about, their descendants that we read about in the time of Christ when he came into this earth. So this is the beginning of these this people that became known as the Samaritans. So what were their ethnic origins or their national origins? As we see, they were ones from these different nations that he named in verse 26, from various places that the Assyrians had conquered. So they were not just one people. They were an assortment of people from different areas. But the Assyrians brought that mixture and put them in the land of Israel as they had taken the inhabitants of Israel out and then scattered them among a mixture of other peoples they conquered. That was what the Assyrians did. So they conquered many lands, especially under Tiglath-Pileser, their emperor. And so they would remove people, mix them all up with a blend of others, and then sort them out in different areas they conquered. So you didn't have one group or one nationality in their homeland once the Assyrians got through with them. So that's what they did here. And so now Israel in this region in central Israel, particularly around Samaria, is now occupied by this assortment of people from these different areas the Assyrians put in there. And so that was their national background. Now they're just known as the Samaritans. What is their religious background? Well, they're idolaters, just like all the other nations around there. And also just like the Israelites from these tribes that the Lord had removed because they had adopted the practices of these idol-worshipping nations around them. How different was the religion of God's people that he had removed from the land compared to the religion of the religious practices of the people that have been brought in now to replace them? I mean, there was really no difference. They each have their particular national so-called gods, and so they all brought their particular flavor of idolatry or brand of it into the land. And we also read how then the Lord sent lions among them, and let it be known that he was displeased with this wickedness that his people had been engaged in, and that's why he had removed them. But he's very displeased with these practices that these people are bringing in, that the Assyrians have put in here in the land. So then how do they address this problem? Now notice I didn't say how did they fix the problem. Did they fix the problem? Did they fix their spiritual problem there? No, they didn't fix it. They addressed it in what way? Well, we're not doing any service to the God of the land is what they were identifying as the problem. Not understanding that they, in neglecting to serve the God of that land, it wasn't the God of that land that they were not serving. It was the God of heaven that they were not serving, the one true and living God. And he was the one that gave them this problem because they weren't serving him. But he's not just one of their many gods, but that's how they looked at it. And so then they just adopted a false way of, they didn't add true worship of Jehovah to their idolatry, because you couldn't do that anyway, but they didn't add truth to it in any way. Who in fact, when they wrote to the king of Assyria about their problem, he addressed it by sending to them one of the priests of Israel that had been carried away out of the land into captivity. And as we noted, those priests that were there in the land of Israel in the northern kingdom, going back to the time of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, were these descendants of Aaron? Were these true priests of the Lord? Or were these priests, whomever would consecrate himself, then they would make them to be priests of the lowest of the people? And that was the problem. And then they weren't priests according to the qualifications that God had given for his priests. And they weren't priests to do service to Jehovah according to God's commandments. These priests of the lowest people, who were false priests, were serving at what altars? These altars of the golden calves that Jeroboam had made. So they were and calling them their gods, and one in Dan and one in Bethel. So, how are one of these priests going to be able to teach the people of this land the proper way to serve Jehovah? What did they know about it? I mean, they weren't doing it themselves. So one of them comes, arrives there, and it says in verse 28, dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord, fear Jehovah. Well, what he misunderstood about it, and obviously it was false. There he was right there in Bethel, one of the main place centers of that false religion that Jeroboam had instituted, and God in this very chapter pointed out how they had all continued to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. These are those sins right here with those priests and the false priests, the false altars, those false gods that they had been serving and all of those things. And so here's one of them teaching them to do that and add that to their idolatry. And that's what they did. And so it tells us that in verse 32, so they feared the Lord and made unto themselves of the lowest of them priests of the high places, which sacrificed for them in the houses of the high places. Well, that whoever came down there, whoever was sent to teach them what to do, taught them what to do, and they did it, didn't they? They made priests just like had been made by the people before them. And again, it's really stunning. But did that priest say, oh yeah, I'm one of the priests that God got out of here because of all of it, and said it was because of all these wrong things that we were doing, but I'm going to now teach you the same wrong things. And why would they, these people, listen to, if they think this is going to gain the favor of the God of the land of Israel, who's just removed these people, why would they, if they're thinking with any kind of logic, why would they listen to somebody that the God of this land had just removed from it to teach them how to stay in it? Does that make any sense? Does that make any more sense than really when Amaziah conquered Edom and then he took their gods led them to defeat at his own hands, supposedly? Of course, they were false gods, but I mean, remember when he started worshiping the gods of the Edomites right after he had defeated the Edomites? If they couldn't help the Edomites, how were they going to help him? Ahaz copied the altar that was in Damascus that had just led to their king Rezin to be defeated by the king of Assyria, and then he brings makes a duplicate of that for Jerusalem. I mean, so we've seen this kind of thing before. Why are people going to turn to the so-called gods that couldn't even help the ones in the lands that they themselves have conquered? Or in this case, here they come into a land that's been conquered and the inhabitants were removed, and then they're going to let one of them teach them how to please the God of that land. I mean, there's no sense to this. This is what you call a strong delusion, and they believe a lie. And so they listen to it, they adopt those practices, and so they add their false version of Jehovah worship to the worship of all these other idols that they've been involved in. So it says in verse 33, they feared the Lord and served their own gods after the manner of the nations whom they carried away from thence. Verse 34, unto this day they do after the former manners. They fear not the Lord, neither do they after their statutes or after their ordinances or after the law and commandments which the Lord commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. So verse 33 says they fear the Lord and serve their own gods. And verse 34 says they do this to this very day. They fear not the Lord. So did they or didn't they? That's exactly it. So they claim to be, but they were doing it wrongly, which means they weren't. So how many, when we look at, and I know we mentioned it last week, but it bears mentioning again as a modern day comparison. How many people in the world today would identify themselves as Christian? A lot. You know, it'd be well over a billion. We can think about, how many people in the city of Columbia, you know, we're in a city, the metro area now is what, somewhere around 750,000, 800,000 people. Yeah, how many of people in, what percentage of metropolitan Columbia would identify themselves as Christian? The vast majority. So they're going to use the term and call themselves Christians. Well, that's the same what was going on here when they said they feared Jehovah. But identifying themselves as worshipers of Jehovah when they were worshiping him and serving him falsely and not keeping his commandments, were they truly servants of Jehovah? No. Well, how many people today who are claiming to be Christians are not following New Testament Christianity according to the Lord's commandments? See, this is 2 Kings 17, when we get to verses 33 and 34, he's letting us see it plainly, that what God defines as being one who worships and serves him is according to what he has commanded. And if whatever we claim doesn't match up with what God has commanded, then what are our claims? Our claims are then false claims, aren't they? So somebody can say they believe in Jesus all day long, and we should say that, but does that mean we are a believer in Jesus just because we say that? Or did Jesus himself in Matthew 7 and verse 21 say, "Why call you me? Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven." Was there any difference in that principle that Jesus expressed in Matthew 7, 21 and the principle we're reading about right here in 2 Kings 17? No difference at all. We're not going to be, based on our claims, be accepted by the Lord just because we claim that we believe in Jesus and we love him and follow him. He's going to judge us according to whether we followed his will or not. And if we're not submitting to his commandments, then we really aren't Christians, even if we say we are, just like these Samaritans claim to be fearing Jehovah now, but they were not in fact because they weren't serving him after his and according to his commandments. So that's a crucial principle for us to recognize, but it's really clear here in 2 Kings chapter 17, especially those two verses where one of them says they feared the Lord and the next verse says they didn't, because one is their claim, the other is speaking about what the actual truth was based in what God's commandments, what his word says. They weren't following that, so they did not fear Jehovah. And so that goes right to the end of the to the chapter, says in verse 41, the last verse, "So these nations feared the Lord and served their graven images, both their children and their children's children, as did their fathers, so do they unto this day." So again, that's defining it by their false claim of fearing Jehovah. They didn't really. He's describing the beginning of the Samaritans, and we can see where they were. They were Gentiles. They were a collection of... they came from a variety of nationalities, but they were all Gentiles brought into Israel and bring in their idol worshiping and then add to it the false customs that had been followed by the people of Israel in that kingdom from back in of the days of Jeroboam the first. And this then persisted to the end of the writing of this of the book of 2 Kings. That means going all the way to the time of the Babylonian captivity. So for the next this starts in 722 BC, and the fall of Jerusalem occurred in 586 BC. So that's 136 years. So by that, that's almost 150 years of history that's summarized in verse 41, and that's why it mentions their children and their children's children. So you're already going to have their descendants down to their grandchildren and beyond by the time the end of this book occurs. Well, what about after that? Is that where it ended? Or did that keep going on for the generations to come until the time of Christ? Well, this is 722 BC, and he's concluding it up to about after 586 BC. That still puts you almost 600 years before Christ. What happened over the next 600 years after that? What do we read about in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Well, before we get to that, and that's really what I want to spend a few minutes on, because we mentioned some of this, but we didn't really get to look at it. So he summarizes that. We're seeing the beginning of the Samaritan people, where they came from, how they got there, what they practiced and observed as far as their religion went. These were Gentile people that did not follow the Lord. That is the distinction between these Samaritans and God's people and what they should be. Now, as far as they come into the land at the time, really, when Hezekiah is going to be bringing the children of Judah back to the Lord. And if ever there were a time when the remaining children of God that were in Israel, which all that's left now is the kingdom of Judah, I mean, along with this tiny tribe of Benjamin and whatever remnants there were from those other tribes when they had, some of those families had moved down and joined themselves to Judah back in the time of Jeroboam and a little bit after that, under the reigns of Rehoboam and Asa when they were kings of Judah. So other than that, I mean, these are all of God's people that are left, and their descendants will be all the ones that ever will be. But if ever there was a time when whatever is left of God's people would say, we better shape up. I mean, how about right now, when all of their brethren to their immediate north, the remainder of all the tribes of Israel have now been carried away, they're gone forever. I mean, would that be would the time be ripe at that point for the lesson of, we better do something about ourselves and what we're doing so we don't end up like that? Which is what Hezekiah does. That obviously was a lesson that was not lost on him personally. I mean, look at his own background with his family. If somebody were to offer an excuse, well, I didn't know better because look at the rotten family I came from. And how many people do like to blame their parents for whatever problems they have? Hezekiah didn't do that. I mean, how many people have ever lived, have had a father that was as rotten as Ahaz? Not many. Not many at all. So did Hezekiah, though, use that as an excuse? I've got one of the most wicked men for a father that anybody's ever had, so therefore I'm going to be wicked and I get a pass. No, he didn't do that. He personally saw what happened to what was happening on all the ways that God was punishing his father and the kingdom of Judah. I mean, we went through that last in 2 Chronicles 28 before we went to 2 Kings 17. That last chapter we were studying in the book of 2 Chronicles, we saw God recounting all those ways that he punished them with the Syrians, with Pekah when he was ruling over Israel until the Assyrians got after him too, as the Assyrians did with Syria. But the Lord had used them, and then he used the Assyrians. I mean, so he used many enemies coming against Ahaz, and they lost much of their army. They had many captives taken. So there were lots of ways, and even one of Hezekiah's brothers and the one that was closest to his father in the kingdom and his court was killed. So, I mean, all of this is happening. Hezekiah gets to see all of this. And then you've got also what happens to the northern kingdom. So Hezekiah has this lesson to observe with his own eyes. But not only does he have that, and especially did he have that, but everybody else in Judah had that. So the time was very, very right for ones to consider that lesson and to listen to the Lord in such a time. And for that generation, there's some success there. But that lesson is soon forgotten immediately after them. And then they become worse even than the northern kingdom, their brethren. And that's going to, other than Josiah, who makes futile efforts, Hezekiah succeeded in his. Josiah is very zealous for the Lord like Hezekiah. But the people are too far gone in heart, and they fake it when he's making them, but they didn't return to the Lord. And so this is, Judah's going to be on the way out, but during Hezekiah's time, there's going to be that moment when they do consider their ways, and what a time to do it. But that distinction between God's people and these Samaritans, as far as who was serving the Lord, I mean, that was very clear in Hezekiah's time. But after that, after Hezekiah, through the decline in Judah to the time of their destruction by the Babylonians and the removal of the remnant that was left into captivity, well, I mean, really, who's left in Israel after Judah's gone? That land is left. I mean, you've got the Samaritans. That's really it. So how did they feel when they're brought into this land that where they were really strangers? They weren't from there, and even though they're there for some generations, I mean, that it was the land that of the people of Israel, and you've got the kingdom of Judah there, we can see from Hezekiah's efforts and that of Josiah, they still regarded all of that land that God gave them as being for their people. So, I mean, immediately that's going to set up the Samaritans and the Jews are not going to be, they're not going to be friends. I mean, the Jews are going to regard them as they were. I mean, these were occupiers of their own land, and they were Gentiles, and they didn't serve the Lord. So that's the beginning of this. And so how are the Samaritans going to view the removal of the remainder of the Jews from the land where they're left alone in it? Is that something they're going to be are they going to lament that? Are they going to be writing letters to the Babylonians and later the Persians? Please send them back. No, they're going to write some letters, but it's not going to say that. It's going to be the opposite. They were glad for them to be gone, and they didn't want them to come back. And when they did come back, how did they greet them? So after the 70 years of captivity in Babylon, when the remnant returns who have repented, led there by Zerubbabel, their governor, and Joshua, the high priest, who were righteous, they come back to the land, sent there by Cyrus the Great, who was the Persian emperor, and financed the rebuilding of the temple. And they come back to rebuild the temple. In Ezra chapter 4, what happens with that work of Zerubbabel and the children of Israel to rebuild the temple in terms of the ones who were around in the land, and really these would be Samaritans. Well, they oppose them vigorously, and they try to stop and thwart their work to rebuild the temple. Ezra chapter 4, let's read verses 1 through 6. Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity builded the temple unto the Lord God of Israel, then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of their fathers and said unto them, Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do, and we do sacrifice unto him since the days of Azarhaddon, king of Azar, which brought us up hither. Now these are the Samaritans. They're referring to the beginning of their time in Israel. What claim are they making about their religion? Yeah, we're serving the same God. We've been doing that since we were brought to the land by. So it would have been they're referring back to Azarhaddon's time, but the Assyrians were the ones that brought them there. and put them in the land, and they're referencing that. We've been serving Jehovah ever since we got here in the land. Well, what did we read in 2 Kings 17? What was that really? In what way were they so-called serving Jehovah from that time? Well, yeah, they put his name to what they were doing, but were they really serving him? Or what did the Lord say about that? Not according to his commandments. What's the difference between this and people in denominations today saying, here, come join with us in our work. We're Christians like you are. I mean, that's the claim. But just because we say we believe in Jesus and other people say they believe in Jesus, does that mean, are we doing the same thing? Are we practicing the same religion? It better be what God commands, but if it's not, then the claim is false, as we've seen. But they're making the claim here, hey, let us help you. We worship Jehovah just like you. We're the same religion. We've been so since we got here, which is false. What did Zerubbabel answer? It says in verse 3, and Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the chief of the fathers of Israel said unto them, you have nothing to do with us to build a house unto our God, but we ourselves together will build unto the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, hath commanded us to do. Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they unto him an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. So yeah, they start the letter writing campaign. So they're doing everything they can to stop the work of the building of the temple. They write letters to the Persian government. Now this is after Cyrus's time, because that would have been Cyrus personally had sent them to do this with the finances to do it, to start the building of the temple. Now after Cyrus's days, then this work was not known directly to his followers, what Cyrus had started there. And so they get letters from these Samaritans accusing these Jews of being rebels, of being ones who were against the Persians. And so that stops the work of the temple for a time. In verses 23 and 24 here in Ezra 4, it says, now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem unto the Jews and made them to cease by force and power. Then ceased the work of the house of God which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So these Samaritans successfully stopped the work of rebuilding the temple for a time, because the letter they wrote was initially believed by the Persians. Well, then the Jews responded to that, and the records, a search of the records by Darius was made of the Persian records, and Cyrus's decree was found, and then the Persians under Darius reauthorized the completion of the temple, and that's what happened. But look at what the Samaritans were doing to that work of rebuilding the temple. They were doing everything they could to stop it, and succeeded for a time in stopping the work. Now later, when Nehemiah came along, and this is well after the rebuilding of the temple, another generation later, Nehemiah arrives being the cupbearer to the Persian emperor, and he's sent by Artaxerxes to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. In Nehemiah chapter 4, when he comes there and starts the work on the wall, what's the response of the people of the land? These are the Samaritans again. Well, they're going to try to stop the work and the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem, just as they had done to stop the work of rebuilding the temple. In verse 1 of Nehemiah chapter 4, it says, when it came to pass that when Sanballat heard that we builded the wall, he was wroth and took great indignation and mocked the Jews. And he spake before his brethren in the army of Samaria and said, what do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? Will they revive the sons, stones out of the heaps of the rubbish which are burned? Now Tobiah, the Ammonite was by him, and he said, "Even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall even break down their stone wall. Hear, O our God, for we are despised, and turn their reproach upon their own head, and give them for a prey in the land of captivity." Well, one of these, that Tobiah, was an Ammonite, but this Sanballat and the others that were around that were helping him, and then they made physical threats against the Jews, and so they were doing everything to thwart the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem, and so this is being led by these Samaritans. So given all this background, the Jews and Samaritans, how would we describe their relations here? I mean, there is a distinction between them as people, and especially in terms of here you have God's, the ones who were serving God and the ones who weren't. I mean, this was God's people and versus the world, and the Samaritans were part of the world. So there's the seeds of this enmity. We can read it here even from the very beginnings in 2 Kings 17 right through to what we're told about when the captives return from Babylon in rebuilding the temple and the walls of the city of Jerusalem. We don't read anything else other than that really about the Samaritans in the Old Testament books, but we can see the roots of what explains what the state of the relations between the Jews and Samaritans were right up into the time that Christ came into this world. So John chapter 4, the Gospel of John chapter 4, verses 3 through 9, this is speaking of Jesus. It says, "He left Judea and departed again into Galilee, and he must needs go through Samaria. Then cometh he to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well, and it was about the sixth hour. Then cometh," so this, that would be noon, "there cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith unto her, Give me to drink, for his disciples were gone away unto the city to buy meat." So they're looking to buy food. It's lunchtime. So verse 9, "Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, How is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." So there she is stating factually what the condition of there weren't any relations between the Jews and the Samaritans. They hated each other so much they didn't even deal with each other. So from those beginnings that we saw in 2 Kings 17, now we're looking at 700 years later and what has changed. I mean, there's nothing that's changed there. They hate each other. So that's where things were right here in the time of Christ. Now, in verse 20, we can see the religious differences have persisted through that time. John 4, verse 20, here's this Samaritan woman. She says, "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." Does she note that there's still a distinction in the religious practices of her people, the Samaritans, versus the Jews? Yeah, and she's tracing the roots back. Our fathers, I mean, this goes back to what we were reading about in 2 Kings 17. They had the physical locations where they were to... the right places where they had their high places, and they made their priests of them, and they had their altars there, and so they were that. Those were the religious practices that they had. She's referring to that. Our fathers, I mean these Samaritans, going back to their origins there, said, "Here's the right place here in the mountain of Samaria. This is where we should be worshiping God. But you say Jerusalem's the right place." So she's noting a difference between the Jews and Samaritans and their religious practices. This goes back to 2 Kings 17. And it persisted all the way through the time of Zerubbabel and Joshua and then Nehemiah. I mean, it's been there all the way through, right to the present time, to the time of Christ. And of course, we know what Jesus, how he answered that and refers to the hour that was coming. Is there a right physical place? I mean, he's teaching the principles of Christianity, of the New Testament that he was establishing. What's the right physical location? Where should we go to properly worship God? There's not a physical place. And I mean, even today, that's central to most religions. There's usually some holy land or location that people identify with. Well, even though historically we know the part of the world, and it is interesting when you can go to places in the world and you can actually see with your own eyes some of the places or some of the things that date back to Bible times. It's very interesting to see. I haven't been to Israel or Jerusalem like Jan has, but I mean, I've seen things in Rome, Athens, and used to be Thessalonica in Greece, and I mean, I've been to a few places like that. Very interesting to me. But do we have? Is there a holy land that we recognize as Christians? And do we face a certain direction when we pray or something, a physical location to identify with? I mean, we don't have a Mecca. We don't have a holy land. We don't have a Vatican. There's not a physical or earthly headquarters to Christianity. Where is our citizenship? Philippians 3:20, it's in heaven. And that's where God's throne is, and Christ is at the right hand of the Father. And that's where our eternal home is to be. There's not a physical location. Do we worship God with our hands, our physical hands? Are there physical offerings that we make to Him? And that's something that Paul addressed from Mars Hill in Athens in Acts 17. God is not worshipped in that manner. So all these this identification of physical ways of worship, Jesus said, the true worshipers worship God in spirit and in truth. And so he taught that there in John 4. In Matthew chapter 10 and verse 5, we can read that, Matthew 10:5. This we'll have this finished shortly here, Lord willing. When Jesus sent forth his 12 apostles, it says, these 12 Jesus sent forth and commanded them, saying, go not into the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So he specifically told the apostles at the beginning of their, when he sent them out, when he was still on this earth, to go to the cities in Israel that were of God's people, the children of Israel, not to go to the Gentiles, not to go to the cities of the Samaritans. Now, would the time come later when the gospel would be spread to Samaria? Yeah, and that's in Acts 8 when Philip the evangelist went and established the church in Samaria. And there were many of these Samaritans that were converted to Christ at that time. So that would come later. But Jesus, the beginning of that, it was to start among God's people. And did he recognize a distinction spiritually between those people of the Lord and these Gentiles and Samaritans? Yes. Now, they all needed to hear the gospel, but it was going to start there among those who were the children of Israel. Now, later on in Luke chapter 9, we have in verse 51, Luke chapter 9, verse 51, we have the Jesus preparing to make his journey to Jerusalem. That's going to eventually, it's going to culminate in his death. But Luke 9:51 says, it came to pass when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem and sent messengers before his face. And they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. And they did not receive him because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem. And when his disciples James and John saw this, they said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elijah did? But he turned and rebuked them and said, you know not what manner of spirit you are of, for the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went to another village. Well, what happened here and why? Well, they're trying to make a place for Jesus to stay on this journey, but they're in this region of Samaria. Whoever was in this area, when they found out here were a bunch of Jews on their way to Jerusalem, how did they feel about that? You're not staying with us. You're Jews going to Jerusalem. Find some other place to go. And even James and John. Now, I mean, John, of course, is referred to as the apostle that that Jesus loved. I mean, he was closest to Christ of any of them. Can we find a more meek and humble and kind heart than the apostle John of Jesus' disciples? That would be difficult or impossible to find anyone more so. And yet, look at the attitudes that even James and John, his apostles, had towards these Samaritans at this time. There was deep-rooted hatred among these people. The Samaritans hated the Jews, and the Jews hated the Samaritans back. When the Jews, when their leaders were trying to, when they had nothing else, when they brought all their false accusations against Jesus, and they were proven to be false. In fact, in John 8, verse 46, Jesus challenged them and said, "Which of you convinceth me of sin? And if I say the truth, why do you not believe me? He that is of God heareth God's words. Ye therefore hear them not, because you're not of God." Now, if they hear he's challenging the ones that hated him the most, these leaders of the Jews. "Which of you convinces me of sin?" Which one of them could accuse him of breaking one of God's laws and be able to show that he had done so? And they couldn't. They had nothing, that's remarkable itself. I mean, here they were helpless to come up with anything that they could legitimately point to accuse Jesus of, when he gives them the opportunity to show me where I've broken God's commandments. They couldn't do it. So when they've got nothing else, then where do they go? Insults. And look at what they're going to hurl, what for them in this time clearly would be the biggest of insults you could give to somebody. Verse 48, "Then answered the Jews and said unto him, Say we not well that thou art a Samaritan and hast a devil?" So when you got nothing else and you're going to just sling mud, and what are you going to call him? You're a Samaritan. I mean, that's obviously, in their minds, the worst thing you could call a person. So that's representative of, again, of the that being one of their chief insults, how the Jews and Samaritans regarded each other. Now, interestingly, of course, we read about the exceptions to this. Did Jesus carry that hatred in his heart for the Samaritans? Now, he knew that they weren't following the Lord, but he knew his own people of Israel largely were not properly either. And he was trying to convert them to God. And the Samaritans, he would also. Now, when he taught the parable, when the Jewish man in Luke 10, 25 through 37, we're not going to read the parable of the what? Of the good Samaritan. When he wanted to know, he said, and he told Jesus, here are the two greatest commandments. And Jesus told him he wasn't far from the kingdom of heaven. And those were to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, Jesus had taught that, and he had heard it, and he repeated it back. Then he said, "Well, who's my neighbor?" And then Jesus, in that parable, said, "Go and do thou likewise," when he said, "Which of them was a neighbor?" To this Jew who had been brutally assaulted and left on the roadside, basically left for dead after being violently assaulted by thieves. And a priest and a Levite passed by their own fellow Jew and did nothing to help him. And then a Samaritan comes along and sees this Jew lying there, and this Samaritan man helps him. Who was the neighbor to him? The Samaritan man. So in that parable, Jesus uses the example of a Samaritan was the neighbor to that Jew. And to answer the question, "Who is my neighbor?" Jesus said, "Go and do thou likewise." So who did Jesus teach that were the neighbors of the Jews? It included the Samaritans. It included everybody. And that's, of course, what he's teaching us as part of his gospel. And by the way, it shouldn't be very difficult for us to be able to make a connection to Look what kinds of things go on in our world today. The kinds of, you know, we read about Jews and Samaritans, how much they hated each other. And look at people and hating each other today, going around shooting somebody or people because you hate what their race or ethnicity is. And I mean, what's the solution to that? The same as what Jesus was teaching there. I mean, we're not supposed to hate anybody. We're supposed to be a neighbor and love everyone. I mean, that's the second greatest commandment. And we can't serve God and love God without obeying that commandment. So Jesus was teaching that then in a time when we can see how much hatred there was among Jews and Samaritans. Luke 17 records the healing of 10 lepers. And after they were healed, they went away to show themselves to the priest. But one came back, one of those lepers who was healed came back and thanked Jesus for healing him of his leprosy. And that one of the 10 who came back and thanked him was a Samaritan. The other 9 were Jews. They didn't come back and thank him. The one who glorified God and thanked Christ for healing him was a Samaritan man at that time. We don't have time right now to go back and look at John 4. We read about that Samaritan woman that Jesus met at the well. I mean, she was living in adultery, and I mean, she'd had multiple husbands and lived with another man. And I mean, so she had an immoral life that she had been living. But Jesus knew who she was and what she had been doing with her life. And he was teaching her. He was teaching her what was right versus what was wrong. That woman then went and got her fellow Samaritans from the village, brought them there to listen to him, and Jesus taught them. And it tells us how there are many that listened to him there. So when he started with teaching the lost sheep of the house of Israel, was that where Jesus' concern for the souls of men stopped? No, he came to die for everyone. And he taught those Samaritans that day. And then he sent his gospel. He instructed his apostles in Acts chapter 1 and verse 8 before his ascension. They were to start preaching the gospel in Jerusalem, but then to go to Judea and Samaria and then the uttermost parts of the earth. He included Samaria in those instructions. And as we noted in Acts 8, Philip the evangelist took the gospel there. There were many that were converted to Christ of the Samaritans. So what starts out as a tale of religious division and hatred, where does it end up once the gospel of Christ arrives? Well, there's no longer, when the Samaritans in Acts 8 are converted to Christ, and you have and other Gentiles, then what happens to that middle wall of partition that divided them before? Jesus came to break that down. And he did. And following Christ in truth is the way to break down all of that enmity, and it did in that case. And as we said, that's the solution. That's still the solution for all the ills in this world today. The problem is people don't know Christ and they don't know his teachings. But, of course, that is where we come in as far as being the light of this world and also spreading that gospel to the world. But we can see much from this history and where it starts in 2 Kings 17 with the Samaritans. Lord willing, next week we'll look at starting 2 Kings 18 with the reign of Hezekiah, which is also covered in 2 Chronicles chapter 29. But let's close going to our Heavenly Father in prayer.